You're listening to a feed of the Association of Music Podcasting at musicpodcasting.org.
In 2009, Erk went to the dark side and became a music podcaster. He discovered that there was a wide, wide selection of music apart from Do-Si-Do by Julie the Band. It's now 2010. And Erk FM comes down the pipe and into your ears bigger, stronger, and faster. Every Friday, it's Erk FM time. Now here's your host of Erk FM, it's Erk. G'day, I'm Erk, and welcome to a special episode of Erk FM, down the pipe and into your ears. This is an interview episode. Of course, you can catch my regular podcast, Erk FM, down the pipe and into your ears, in the middle of... Oh, hang on, I'll stuff that up. I'll have to edit myself. G'day, I'm Erk, and welcome to episode 117 of Erk FM. Erk FM, of course, in the month of November, is celebrating No Rock-vember. Last month, we had Rocktober, where we had a lot of rock and metal songs, but I thought that I'd redress the balance and bring it back a step and go for something a little bit softer and a bit mellower, and some people would say a bit nicer. Now, of course, each and every Friday we have the regular episode of Erk FM, where a selection of pod-safe, independent and unsigned music comes down the pipe and into your ears each and every Friday. And on Tuesdays we have the occasional interview episode. On the line we have a special guest calling us from Boston in the US, and it's Arthur Nasson. Hello, Arthur. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. How are you?
Mate, absolutely great to hear you and great to talk to you today. For those listeners who didn't hear Friday's episode 113 that you were featured on, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what sort of music you play?
Well, I really like to be open to a number of different ideas. I do make rock songs that I guess you could say were influenced by, you know, things like the Beatles and Steely Dan and Todd Rundgren and so forth. But I also do experimental recordings where I try to branch out with things that maybe don't have necessarily the same type of structure or are maybe harmonically different or sound different. So I really try to be open to a lot of different ideas.
And what instruments are you playing at the moment?
On my recordings, I typically play all of the instruments. I play piano, keyboards, theremin, bass, drums. I do the vocals, backing vocals, percussion, all of that kind of stuff, noises, you name it.
Obviously not at all at the same time, though.
I'm not an octopus, contrary to what people might say. No, it's one at a time. You know, sometimes two at a time. Sometimes, like, percussion and backing vocals can happen at the same time on the same track, but typically no. Well, sometimes piano and voice can happen at the same time, or guitar and voice can happen at the same time, but, you know, nothing like sprouting different limbs and going and doing things like that.
How hard is it for you to switch instruments during a show? Do you switch instruments during a show?
Lately, what I've been doing is I'll start an evening with piano and voice, and then I'll go to guitar and voice. And sometimes it'll be different. I might start with guitar, but typically it's been starting with piano. And there are some evenings where I'll just play piano and sing all night, and some I'll play guitar and sing all night. So the switch isn't really all that difficult. It's pretty simple.
And do you sometimes find yourself singing and either playing the guitar or playing the piano and you forget the words, or you get too involved in playing the instrument and then you think, oh, hang on, I'm singing as well?
Yes. It happens all the time. I'll miss entire verses sometimes. I'll miss sometimes I'll miss it. If I'm lucky, I miss it and kind of catch up with it. You know, I might drop a couple of words and then come back to it. But sometimes, yeah, I mean, I'll just drop all that stuff, or I'll miss entire weeks or months or whatever. It's just, yeah, it can be tough.
Now, partly because of my accent, I have to be very careful how I say the next word. Apart from anything else, that would also make you a penist.
There's no question about that, yes. Depending on your accent, I think that, you know, the meaning and derivation as well could be taken into a few different directions. Yeah.
Yes, that's been a bit of a running joke between my mum and myself, who host Judy's Blast FM. Would you describe yourself as a classically trained penist?
No. I do have a degree in music, but I studied in a more contemporary and not in the typical kind of conservatory style. I didn't want to go for that. A lot of it had to do with, from a child, with sight reading. I didn't gravitate toward sight reading. I gravitated toward playing by ear.
So basically, for the listeners at home, and myself really, who might not be aware of the difference, what's the difference between sight reading and playing by ear?
Well, with sight reading, everything is, you know, very, very specifically, you're playing what is written on the page. And there is no or little room for, there's arguments about this, of course, but there's little room for interpretation or, and there's no room for improvisation unless it's written into the chart where somebody says, okay, from measure 212 to 207 D5, you can improvise. But it's different. With chord charts and things like that, people will have an outline and they'll be able to interpret how it goes and do that. I also, from the time I was a child, didn't really have great vision. So sight reading was frustrating for me as well for those reasons also. And it wasn't really understood that my vision wasn't so great until I was well into grade school. And so, you know, that's kind of another problem. But it trained my ears to be able to hear anything and pick it up and play it right away.
So let's go back to your childhood. How did you get into music in the first place, and what did you start to play originally?
Piano. There was a piano in the apartment, and so I just, you know, I just gravitated toward, you know, making noise initially on it. And then after a while, I just got bored with beating on the thing and decided to try to pick out melodies. And what I found was that I could hear things, let's say on the radio or whatever, and pretty quickly figure out what the melody was. So that's kind of what I'm still doing now.
Do you remember your first song that you ever played? I know it might be a bit of a long shot.
No, it's an interesting question, but I don't remember it. I don't remember. I remember that what I wanted to do earlier on from the beginning was I wanted to write my own songs. So from the time I was very young, I just kind of looked at it like, well, I could just make something up instead. And so that was really, I guess, more of what I wanted to do. So I figured it out from a young age.
So how old would you have been when you first picked up the piano?
Four. Yeah, 4 or 5.
4 or 5. And talk me into the through the progression and into other instruments as you grew up.
Okay, well, I was fascinated with the piano and played that a great deal. But there was, I guess there were a lot of things that happened with rock music that got me interested, and I wanted to... I think I started at the same time I started getting interested in both guitar and drums, and I wanted to really be able to do those things, and so I guess I started from there, and I wound up playing guitar and drums and bass and all of those things, and yeah, and basically what happened was I would sit and listen to things like Beatle records, and I would try to figure out all of the different parts on the recording. I try to figure out the guitar parts, the vocals, the harmonies, the piano parts, the bass parts, the drumming, all of that stuff.
And so why the guitar? Why the drums? Was there any influences there that led you to gravitate, or was it merely the music and you just wanted to play along, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that there were both. I think that the music, I still find it charming. The sound of drums and guitars and pianos, I just, those instruments I really gravitate toward. And after time, there were certain guitar players and certain drummers that I was very interested in. But I think that it was more about initially the sound of these things, that they had this, there was just this really freeing kind of sound. It was different from something like classical music or jazz, where it was much more open and expressive, and it just seemed like a lot of fun to do.
And when did you decide to, quote-unquote, get serious about it and not just play in the lounge room for yourself for your own enjoyment? When did you decide to take it up to the next level?
Well, it's strange, but to great laughter as a young child at the age of 7, I announced to my family that I was going to be a composer. And I've been kind of, I guess I would say that I took it more serious. I went pro in my early teens, you know, playing in horrible bands, playing covers at dances and things like that. But I guess I got more serious as well in college. You know, I think that there's been a real direction and real passion for it all along. And my level of maturity was sort of what, you know, what sort of spelled out how deeply I was going to get into it at the time.
And so as you were growing up and getting into adulthood, and now your music is available on the internet and I can play your music to a worldwide audience basically by doing a podcast out of my lounge room at home here in Australia, what sort of changes have you noticed have affected you the most in terms of music and music technology and things like that?
I can't tell you how thrilled I am with the digital revolution. I was somebody who, on so many levels, just didn't fit into the corporate game of what the record business was here in the United States. And there were a number of companies that would either contact me or contact my various handlers at the time and say, gee, this guy's really great, but it's like, what do we do with it? You know, and it was like, well, it's obvious what you do with it. But I think that the music industry went into a bizarre kind of place by the 80s, and it became really anti-creativity in my estimations and my opinions. I thought that it really became very corporate and very cookie cutter. And so if you didn't want to play along with whatever trends were happening at the time, you were out of luck. And now everyone, every single person gets to put out whatever they want to put out. And I just think that is, it's unlike any other time in history. And I think it's just the most exciting time that we've ever seen as far as music is concerned.
I've spoken to some other musicians, and in the past they've said that the ease that someone could record their own music, play their own music, and get their own music out there has been both an advantage because it's so easy and you don't need to go through these record companies, but it's also been a disadvantage because anyone can basically put it out and there's no filter about how good it is. What do you think about that?
I think you're a filter. You're an example of a filter. You found something, and for whatever reason, you found something interesting about what I was doing. You have started your own podcast, and you don't have to listen to anybody or adhere to anyone's taste in whatever. So there, a filter has happened. So we have, in our own interaction here, created our own sense of what we want to put out there culturally. And I think that's what's fascinating. Yes, it is splintered all over the place. It's not like, okay, we go to one specific area. There's only one station or one video station or something like that. And that rules. It's not that. And I think that's wonderful because I think that was getting stale. And I think that what's going to happen, there's a guy here in the United States named Sumner Redstone who runs Viacom, which is a huge entertainment conglomerate. And he said that in the digital era, content will be king. And I think he's absolutely right about that. And I think the cream can rise in this case. And I think in the major label system in the United States anyway, everything was being suppressed. I think good material, and I could point to a lot of different people and groups that I saw that were really fascinating and just tremendously talented who were not getting a chance to be heard within that system.
Have you dealt with any other music podcasters, or do you have any online media such as a Facebook, or are you on Twitter, for instance, MySpace?
Yeah, I'm on MySpace. Anyone who wants to befriend me on either MySpace or Facebook, you can just plug in my name, Arthur, and the last name is Nason. It's spelled N-A-S-S-O-N. Yeah, and anybody who wants to befriend, I'm very friendly. Twitter, I haven't really... I have a Twitter account under my name, so if anyone wants to join, that's great. For some reason, I haven't really gravitated toward it as much just yet. But I think Facebook's pretty interesting, and I think it's a lot of how everything will change within the new music business, is that this thing will happen online. The people will find out about things and share things, and that's, I think, how it's going to go.
Have you dealt with any other music podcasters, for instance?
There was one, two of them actually. One was the two local ones here to Boston, the Beantown Review. If you go to iTunes, you can hear it. And there's another one called the Boston Local Music Show, which I was on. And this was hilarious. I went into, this happened, I'd say maybe a few weeks ago. And I went downtown Boston and I'm wandering around and it's this, I go down this alleyway to this place and I go upstairs and I don't know what I can say on the podcast, but I walk into the place and there was just this enormous cloud of smoke. And I think you understand what the smoke was. And these guys were just having a ball for themselves. And it was just this wild experience. I don't partake in any of that stuff, you know, but thought, you know, I didn't have any problem with it either. They were just sitting there and they were just, you know, laughing themselves silly and making all kinds of different jokes and smoking a lot and having a great time for themselves. So that was Boston Local Music Show, I think it's called. Pretty fun.
Speaking of smoke, you would have performed in a wide variety of venues over the time, from, you know, growing up until right now. You know, you've been in the music a long time. Have you noticed the difference? Is it smoke-free over in bars over there yet?
You know, it is, but what's funny about it is that a lot of people still smoke. And the last club date that I did, it was still warm enough in October here that... we left some of the front doors open and everything, and all the smoke came drifting in. So it was just like playing a smoky club in the old days, too. It was kind of funny.
So you've definitely noticed the change for the better?
I think it's much better, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's – I mean, if somebody wants to smoke, that's their business. But I think that for them to just be able to duck outside quickly and do that is fine. But still, a lot of it does come – floating back in, so it's a little better, yeah.
What sort of venues have you performed in?
I've played all kinds of different things over the past, but typically it's been nightclubs, art spaces, colleges, let's see, there's been some small theaters over the years, all kinds of different things like that.
And what would be your favorite sort of venue? Do you prefer to have a small, intimate crowd that's paying attention, or do you want a bigger crowd?
I like it all. I really don't. I think that there are different kinds of ways that you deal with those different things, and I like all of it. I try to be very conscious of interacting with what the situation is and what it calls for. It doesn't mean that I totally, you know, change what it is I do, but it means that I temper it to a degree. If it's a small, intimate room, then you can really get more personal about things, and you can do that. And if it's a larger room, it's time to get a little bit louder and more blustery and all of that stuff. I think they're both fun.
Now, we said before that you play piano and, you know, you also play guitar and drums. How do you go with particularly the piano in a live venue? It's not as if you can take a piano with you.
It's getting harder to find them in different venues, too. It used to be that a lot of nightclubs would have a piano at least set up. There are some places that still do, and I gravitate toward those rooms, and we mic up a piano and put it through the PA system. So, I mean, it's got that sound. It's very different from a digital keyboard. I can remember, you know, way back when everyone said, oh, the digital keyboards will just take over. There'll be no reason to have a piano ever again. And I just disagree. I think digital keyboards are great. But there's something so different about an acoustic piano. And they can be mic'd up plenty loud.
So just talk me briefly, because I'm not really sure. Talk me briefly through how you'd actually mic up a traditional piano.
there are a number of different ways and there are a number of different sounds you can get with it. It is, it's one of the instruments that I think, because of typically the string length, even on an upright, and the way the soundboard is constructed, that you can really do this in a lot of different ways. Lately, for me, what I've been doing is I've been miking below the key bed on an upright, on the back of it and on the soundboard. I have not been like opening up the front and putting it near the strings or putting it up high or putting it low there. I've been going to the back of the piano an awful lot lately, and I've been liking the results that I get with it.
And is there any major difference, apart from things like effects, is there any major difference between how you'd play a piano and how you'd play keyboards?
Well, there's an entire system with a piano that is a strike action, and that feels totally unlike any kind of a digital keyboard. They try to simulate that and call it a weighted action. And some of them play fine, but they are just two very, very different things. And some digital keyboards as well have a thing called latency, which means that you're playing something and it takes a little time to catch up with what you're exactly doing. And if a piano is in good shape, it doesn't do that at all. Same thing with a digital. If a digital is in good shape, it won't do that either.
Speaking of pianos, how do you check to make sure that the piano is in a good enough condition to play? I'm assuming that some of these pianos have been in these places for many years.
There are some that are really well maintained and are a pleasure to play, and there are some of them that are in just such disarray that they are, that there's sections of the piano that don't work, that just don't function. And yeah, you got to just go and sit there and play through the keyboard and go through every section of it and find out if there are notes that just don't work, if there are, you know, mechanical problems with the piano. I mean, it can be very, very difficult. It really can be.
And I know I'm sort of going backwards and forwards between the keyboards and the pianos, but what would be your favorite digital effect when it comes to a keyboard? Have you got like one favorite that you really love?
There's an analog modeled synthesizer that I've been using a lot now by Roland, which is the SH-201. And it's an inexpensive thing that really models a lot of what, high-end analog synthesizers do. And it's just a fraction of the price of it. And I think it sounds amazing. So I'm using that a great deal. Sometimes I'll use different digital keyboards for, you know, all kinds of sounds. I'm very interested in synthesis as well. There's no question about that. But I view them as two different things.
Do you ever think that you'll see the day where you'll just say, no more piano?
Never. Never in my lifetime. Never, ever, 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 ever.
Well, that's good to hear. So we'll sort of move on from that sort of thing and turn into the dynamics more of singing, songwriting, and also how you come up with your songs. What inspires you with your music?
There are so many things. With this recording, Echo Garden, this album, it's funny. It was a very different experience for me. I was writing in a way where I was really just letting things out very quickly. I wasn't being as intellectual and I wasn't spending as much time editing as I was writing. And so as I let all of these things out and all of these very different things came out, after they were all recorded, I sort of sat back and realized that this is very different and these things need to be basically set up in a different way. And they represent different things to me within my kind of artistic expression. So the record came out in three parts. And I think the three parts represent different phases of life. And I think that part one really deals with innocence. And, you know, that we deal sometimes do things in ways that are thoughtless and childlike, and that as we mature, hopefully, we begin to understand the ramifications of our actions. And then as we get into the second part, I think the second part is really about, after we've collected all of these experiences, we draw much further inward and reflect on them and try to really understand more of them. And part three is where we reemerge, hopefully a little wiser and you know, having the openness and childlike wonder of a child, but also have it tempered with the maturity of adulthood, and hopefully, you know, to try and build a more positive life. So it was really influenced by all of these different life experiences, this specific record. But most of them, I mean, I'm influenced by so many things. So many different ideas may come into my mind, and they may trip off some different direction or some different idea, and I may just run with that.
So when it comes to the album Echo Garden, I've got the complete list of the songs in front of me. Can you tell by listening to it when it changes from part one to part two to part three? Is it that pronounced that they'll go, oh, okay, he's moved on, he's on part two or he's on part three, if people listen to this episode and listen to the whole album?
I think so. I think, but also I've heard that some people just view it more as one whole thing. But it, in one way, it doesn't really matter. I think that however anyone wants to interact with it and what they get or don't get from it is their personal interaction with it. I have my ideas about it, but in a sense, once I've put it out there, my ideas matter to me. And I think that anyone who wants to interact with it, their ideas matter to them. So I think that you can hear a difference between these sections. I think that they are distinctly different. And I think that, to me, they represent different types of things. But I also will sit there and see that it can really function as, and it's supposed to function as, one entire piece with these three different distinct sections.
And I noticed with a couple of exceptions, the songs are relatively short compared to other music, for instance, that I'd play in my podcast. Any particular reason for that? For instance, you've got a song that lasts for 34 seconds.
One of the things that I've noticed about this album was when I would listen to things as a kid, like different classical music or different rock music, sometimes there would be this one part. And to me, this one part would really just be the most important section or the most powerful or beautiful section of the music. And in this, what I decided to do was to focus on that. Take these things apart and focus on that one section. Some of these parts, like the first song, it's not really a song, it's kind of a vocal and piano piece. That is the chord progression to the following song. So the first one is called Summer Drops, and the second one is called Bounce. And if you listen to Bounce, you can hear that in the verse chord progression, it's the same chord progression as in what Summer Drops is. But I took Summer Drops, and I took this section, and I made it into a completely different piece. And I wanted to focus on, okay, these melodic ideas over these chords really work for me. Now, how do I take it and really just wring everything out of it, but also just, you know, make it as colorful and as beautiful as possible in with what I saw within these progressions?
I really do understand that, because there are some parts in a song where I've listened to it, and I will actually go and download the song, and I'll get into the audio software, and I'll just chop out that little bit that I like, and I'll keep that aside and just keep playing that bit. So I understand what you're saying.
Interesting. That's an interesting thing to do. I find that iTunes is amazing, because sometimes when you get the 30-second samples, sometimes they'll hit it right and you'll get the part of the song that you really want to hear. And, I mean, you may go by the song as well, but sometimes you'll just hear that one section that really just, you know, knocks it out of the park, you know, and really makes it, you know, wonderful. But it's interesting.
When iTunes do that, I have never submitted any music to sell on iTunes. When they have the 30-second preview, is that the first 30 seconds of the song, or is that just a random part of it?
I think that they go, let's say the song is 3.5 minutes. I think they go in 30 seconds to a minute, and then they do 30 seconds from there. But I think it might be different depending on the distributor. I'm pretty sure that they want to catch you into the middle of the song so that you're not... Like sometimes, like look at Echo Garden that you just played. That has a long introduction. And if you started with 30 seconds of the introduction, you wouldn't really get a full sense of where the song was and where it's going.
Whereas if you made the 30 seconds really great to start with, well, you know, some people might think, oh, yeah, that's a really good song. I'll download it. And then the rest of the song is a disappointment, which is not what you want.
Yeah, I think, though, that I guess if you get specific about that song, about Echo Garden, it just, it travels to so many places over the course of, I don't know, it's over 5 minutes long. It's one of the longest pieces, or the longest piece on the recording. And it just travels to so many different places over that period of time that I think it would be hard to snip out 30 seconds and say, well, this is representative of what's going on, but it's really just not the whole story.
So while we're on the subject of Echo Garden, let's hear it. Why don't we talk a little bit about what the song actually means?
In a way, I hope it means personal things to each person who wants to interact with it. To me, what I see in it is, as we grow and as we evolve, I think we can get to a place where we are happy as adults, and where we can see things, we can see the beauty of life. We can see things in a really, you know, we get past being a moody teenager or a disgruntled 20-something, and, you know, and hopefully get to a place where there is small, if you will, joy in life. And I that's kind of a place that I try to be. I would like to, and I consider myself to be a very happy person, but would like to really focus on trying. I think happiness is a choice.
Awesome. So here we are. Here is Echo Garden from the album of the same name.
I wanna stay all day in Echo Garden. I want to swing around on tulip chandeliers. I want to build a path where time will never find us.
Welcome back. You're listening to Erk FM, and that song was called Echo Garden, and we'll have another song from the album of the same name shortly. But Arthur, let's talk a little bit about how you actually write the songs and how the process actually works. For you, do the lyrics come first, or does the tune or the melody come first?
It is different all the time, and I think it helps me to write more, to be open to all ideas at all times. Sometimes a lyrical idea or a concept or a title will take place. Sometimes a chord progression will get me going into a direction. Sometimes it's a number of things. So the more open I can be to all of the possibilities at all time, the less likely I'm ever to have, you know, what people call writer's block.
So if you get writer's block, what has worked for you in relation to getting rid of writer's block?
I don't view that I've ever had writer's block. I view it that there are times when it's time to really write, and I also view it that there are times to really observe and process and think about life. So I view the whole thing as a process. I've never really felt stuck artistically. Because, I mean, I put out even avant-garde recordings and things like that. So if I feel that within dealing with very structured rock songs that I don't really feel like I want to go into that right now, I'll go into something completely different, and it will just open up this new avenue and this new way of looking at things for me. So I think that the way people get stuck is if they have to kind of write the same sort of thing over and over again. I think that... and I'm fortunate in that I don't have to answer to, you know, a record company who's saying, give us, you know, 10 songs that are all going to be something that we could maybe bring to the radio and do that for this one and the next one and the next one and the next one and the next one. I think that's how somebody, you know, there are bands who kind of sound the same from album to album to album. And I really want to avoid that at all costs.
What's the strangest or the most interesting place that you've ever written a song?
Interesting place?
Yeah.
Huh.
Like you might have been on holiday or something like that, and you've just had an idea and you've just had to go with it.
Those types of situations happen all the time. I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but sometimes when I'm doing really menial tasks, ideas will come to me. Like I might be vacuuming, or I might be washing dishes, or I might be doing laundry or something like that. And all of a sudden, this idea will come to me. So sometimes I think that it's the mundane kinds of things as well. But there are times when where I've gone out into nature, or where I've had experiences, or, you know, in cities or wherever that that get the idea going. So it's all over the place. But I think that more often than not, in the mundane things, I can focus on ideas more. And that's where things begin to ferment.
So I might have to go to the elephant enclosure, because we've been trying here on Channel Oak to get an artist to write my mum Judy an elephant song, because she's absolutely obsessed by them. So I might have to go to the elephant, take someone to the elephant enclosure.
Well, I think that showing them a good picture of it as well might be interesting. And see, I think that there's a lot of ways to. Do you write songs as well?
I'm in the middle of writing an elephant song at the moment, but not usually, no.
Well, maybe this will be the place where you start. This might be the way that you go about it. I would, you know, start thinking about, well, what is your idea of what you want the elephant to sound like? What kind of thing do you want it to convey? And, you know, to go on from there.
So that's cool. So that's given a bit of food for thought. I'm going to ask you the question that I ask every artist or every author when I interview people for my talk podcast. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, you're asleep, and you've got a really great idea for a song. What do you do?
Sometimes I just go back to sleep and forget it. Sometimes I do get up and I have a notebook by the side of the bed, and sometimes I will jot it down. If it's really blaring at me, I might get up, put on headphones, and start to plug in like an electronic keyboard or guitar and flesh out the song. So it's a lot of things. It just depends.
Interesting answer. When you were producing Echo Garden, did you go to a studio, or are you in the position where you're lucky to have a home studio?
I have a home studio, and it's it's technologically, it's ancient history. I record my albums on 8-track analog. So, I mean, this is kind of like going back to dinosaurs and what are the platform shoes and scary makeup and glam rock and film. No, that's pre-glam rock. I guess it's kind of where things got to by the mid to late 60s. So that's how backward my methods are, but I prefer it to digital, actually. I think it's more fun.
So briefly, talk me through the process. How does it get from the analog to the digital?
I do mix to a digital medium, and then I go to a mastering room here in the Boston area that's a very good mastering room, and then we take it and edit and try to maximize the sound there. But I record everything incredibly simply and in a way that most people would consider archaic. I recall that when digital was coming out, I realized that I was either going to have to be a slave to technology, or I was going to have to go backward into some of the ways of the past. And I chose to go backward very, very willfully. I was actually one of the first people who, around in the area that really embraced digital recording early on. And what I realized is that I didn't really like the way it sounded, and I also found that it was very cumbersome to operate. So this was a conscious choice to go backward, and I've never had more fun recording in my life than doing it this way. I record drums with one mic and one track. People haven't done that since the 60s.
So for you, what's the difference between recording and playing to a live audience?
I view them as two completely different things, and I want to try to explore both and accept that they're different things and explore both fully. There are groups who are out there that basically, okay, well, we're going to make sure that we play it this way in the studio so that we can just replicate it live in the exact same way. I have no interest, in that whatsoever. To me, they're just radically different things. And I want to take the studio out as far as I can, and I want to take live out as far as I can and just really interact with those things fully.
And when it comes to performing live, do you have any preparations that you do? Any superstitions?
Superstitions. Maybe I've developed OCD over the years, but I don't think I have any particular superstitions. I try to, if I'm rested, I'm going to sing better. if I've rehearsed the material, I'm going to be much more relaxed because I won't be focused on, oh God, am I going to, like earlier in the conversation, am I going to forget a bunch of words and just be sitting up there mumbling for a while? So if I do the preparation, then it's kind of like, okay, well, hope for the best. You know, get out there and try to do the best you can.
Have you noticed a big change in live music compared to the past? I know here in Australia we are having a decline in live music because of things like anti-smoking laws, drink driving, and things like noise by surrounding residents. Have you noticed a similar thing in the US?
There has been. I think that also some of the things that happen are there's this phenomenon that's been here for well over a decade, which is DJs, where people will just come in and they will play background music or dance music or any number of different things, and these DJs will take over the evening rather than a band being up there. And I think that also less and less there are fewer people who have really taken the time to become very proficient at their instruments. And I think that what I see is the club scene is dwindling here in like Boston and New York and places like that. People are less interested in going out and hearing music, which I think is a shame.
At the moment on Twitter, there's a bit of a meme going on where people are basically sending messages back or receiving messages from their 16-year-old self. If current-day Arthur could go back and tell 16-year-old Arthur something different, what would it be?
I don't think I'd change a thing. I don't have any regrets in life. I'm the kind of person who just... I walked my own path, did my own things, and didn't really... You know, I pursued happiness throughout all of this. So I would basically say, yeah, just keep doing what you're doing. Things will turn out fine.
Do you think that if you were like a child or a teenager or a young adult today, do you think that things would be a lot different compared to someone who's had all this experience with analog? What do you think it's like for a younger artist coming up these days who have got no knowledge about the things that you know about?
I think that the technology is part of it, but I think that the biggest part is that these kids don't have today's equivalents of, if you will, musical heroes. And I think that it's harder for them, the little kids that I talk to, you know, who are teenagers, I ask them, well, what do you listen to? They're all saying the same things. Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, you know, groups like that. And I think the reason is because the groups of today haven't really surpassed that stuff. Or let's put it this way, aren't really bringing those ideas into the next kind of place.
I understand what you're talking about because normally on this show when I read through an artist's bio, I'll try and find something interesting about them, and sometimes the only thing that I can find out are their influences. And even for bands that have got a lot of 19, 20, 21-year-olds, it's amazing how many people will say, you know, I like the Beatles, I like Led Zeppelin, you know, things like that.
I honestly think that I'm still listening to box music, you know? So there's, you know, hundreds of years later, I mean, there is, I think it was Dizzy Gillespie who said it. He said, there's only two kinds of music, good and bad. And I think that what he really was saying was that ideas either work and they're well executed and they're compelling and we find them as humans that we want to engage with them or we don't. And I find a lot of what's coming out in the mainstream from corporate record companies, I don't, personally, it doesn't resonate with me. If it resonates with others, wonderful. But for me personally, a lot of it, I just don't relate to it. I just don't get into it. It's not fulfilling and interesting to me to interact with it.
So let's go back to your album Echo Garden. What would be your favorite song on the album?
That's such a hard question because it's such a varied album with so many different types of ideas on it. Even if you said, what's your favorite song in each section, I think that would be a very hard question for me to answer. I like the way Bounce came out. I like the way The Other Side and Unglued came out. I think Bubblefish, both parts, one and two, I think are beautiful. I really like the title cut, Echo Garden, a lot. I'm trying to think. Yeah, I mean, but when you get into the middle and the Stranger stuff, like Unravel and Drift and Orb, I think are beautiful. I think Firefly Chase is different. It's just, I'm so happy with how this came out. I really just am thrilled with this recording, and I'm glad to be able to share it.
Is there one song out of the album that the fans have come back and said, Arthur, this song's my favorite?
There are two three that really come up most, which would be actually four. Okay. Bounce, Unglued come up a lot. There's a band that's going to be covering Unglued on their next record, and they've asked me to sing on it as well, which is going to be great fun. And some people say The Other Side is their favorite, and a lot of people say that Echo Garden is their favorite cut. So those handful out of the 18 are the ones that people... but radio right now, it's mostly Bounce and Unglued, and some people play Echo Garden.
You've got an interesting song here, song number 13, The Boy with the Backwards Guitar. Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, this record is different in that... I usually play all of the instruments, but this time I have my two young sons play along with me. And my oldest son, Graham, plays drums on, he plays drums on Unglued, he plays drums on Echo Garden, he plays drums on Drag, on a handful of cuts. And my younger son, Colin, has basically been fascinated with the experimental side of what I do. And one morning he just said to me, hey, Dad, I want to start playing one of your electric guitars with a pair of chopsticks, and I want you to run it through all your weird backwards effects. And I was just sort of like, what? It's like the Austin Powers movie where it's like, it's mini-me all of a sudden. and he starts to do all of this, and he starts to do some weird things with tunings. And then he said, I want to bang my feet on the carpet here, and I want you to put a mic on the floor and record it. And so all of these different things, there are some recorders that we put on there, and then, of course, I started to put all of this stuff together, and he really just wanted to do... I mean, Firefly Chase is also similar in that he wanted to be involved in doing some of these different things, and he really, for some reason, liked more of the experimental kind of ideas. So that's how that piece came about. And I think it's pretty cool.
So why don't we hear that now? Here is The Boy with the Backwards Guitar.
Thank you.
So, Arthur, we just heard the boy with the backwards guitar, and you said that both your sons have played a part in the album. What's the future for you, and what's the future for them? Are they going to follow in your footsteps?
I think that my oldest son right now would like to be a professional musician, and I'm going to be starting to do some touring in and around the United States, and I think by summertime he might even do some shows with me in and around the United States. And my younger son, while he's interested in music and enjoys it, I think that he is actually fascinated right now with architecture. And we've been talking all about like Frank Gehry, and I think he'd like to build just very different kinds of buildings and do things like that. And they say that composition, music composition and architecture are supposed to be kindred in some big way. So that's how it goes. But he has both of them have extraordinary ears and affinity for music and are able to just sit at instruments and start making stuff happen.
So what's the future? You've got a tour coming up of the US, and you can go to your website to find out where and when, because of course this podcast, even though it's coming out of Australia, we do have listeners across the US.
Yeah, you'll be able to find tour dates soon enough on there, or maybe on Polestar as well, but probably if you just go to my site, I'll post them as soon as I know them. We're in the process. I thought it was going to happen earlier than it did, but it looks like I'll be going out in the cold this year. So it's things will happen even into January, which in the Northeast is it's kind of cold. I think that what I'm going to do is I'm going to get on the train, and I'm just going to kind of do the Amtrak tour and bomb around on the train that way so I don't have to drive through the snow.
I was thinking you'll be doing a lot of gigs in places like Florida and Texas and Southern California to get away from the snow.
That might happen in the future, but the initial round, I'll go further south as the winter comes on, but I think that initially it's going to be like, New York City, of course, Philadelphia, Boston, Providence, Rhode Island, New Haven, Connecticut, maybe Portland, Maine, Albany, New York, some of those places are going to be the initial sort of starting point.
So on a sort of unrelated note, does the snow bother you that much?
No. I just think that I'd heard about some people coming over to the United States, and I heard about this on radio here on NPR, National Public Radio here, that they were talking about these artists who just did a solo tour, which is what I'm going to start with, and they just got on the train, and they bought a rail pass, and it was like they had a bag and a guitar, and they just went on the train, and it just sounded really kind of romantic to me rather than doing it the other way.
Just as long as you don't try and take your piano on the plane, I suppose, on the train.
Yeah, I mean, the uprights with wheels, I suppose I could wheel them around the cities, but, it's kind of tough.
Do you fly around at all, or you just train or car?
I imagine that in time I'll be flying around to a lot of places. But right now what I'd like to try and do is to do it incrementally and just do it by the train or car.
Yeah, I think that in places like America and places like Australia, they're so big that the train, while it might be slower, it's also a lot better because you don't have to worry about the driving.
I think that, in some of these places, I've done shows as well on the train where what happens, I'll do the show, I'll get off the stage, and sometimes I'll get like a 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning train out of there. And, it just kind of works that way, too.
Awesome. So where can we find you on the interweb? Where can people buy your albums? Where can people find out where these gigs are going to be?
Well, the best place to buy the albums, of course, is iTunes. I think everyone, I don't know, I love iTunes. I wonder if everyone else does. But iTunes is by far the best place to go for all of this. You can find all 6 of the albums that I've produced on there. And if you want to go to my site, arthurnason.com, you can read different stuff and hear different things and maybe find out about tour dates as they get posted and all of that stuff.
Awesome. Arthur, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
So that was Arthur Nason. Thank you, Arthur. It's been an absolute pleasure. A great way to continue during No Rock Vember. I've never really spoken to a pianist before, so, and, you know, you've played a lot of different instruments as well, but it's been an absolute pleasure, mate, and I hope that the tour goes well. And any plans for any future albums anytime soon?
I always want to be creating and recording, and I'm hoping to get back into that as soon as possible.
Awesome. Speaking of getting back into things as soon as possible, don't forget you can tune in on Friday for week number 2 of No Rockvember as we redress the balance from Rocktober. But until then, on behalf of Arthur and myself, it's good night, Interweb. Have been listening to a Channel Irk production. Channel Irk and all 5 podcasts are licensed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative, share-alike license registered in Australia. Music is used with direct permission or under agreements with various music providers. All rights to the music contained within remains with the original rights holder. Some sound effects are sourced from the Free Sound Project under Creative Commons. For more information about Channel Irk, go to www.channelirk.com. You have been listening to a Channel Irk production. Channel Irk and all 5 podcasts are licensed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative, share-alike license registered in Australia. Music is used with direct permission or under agreements with various music providers. All rights to the music contained within remains with the original rights holder. Some sound effects are sourced from the Free Sound Project under Creative Commons. For more information about Channel Irk, go to www.channelirk.com.